This letter, Dr. Craig says, even as an atheist, I cannot bring myself to approve of abortion at any stage after conception because I believe it to be a unique life form, and I believe all of life is precious. I read your post on abortion and was delighted to see you explain in detail the moral degeneracy of abortion. However, I feel you've left out a few points you could touch on in detail. Common rebuttals I get to this point goes as follows. The right to life is for those who live as beings with emotions, are self-aware, and thought. Therefore, abortion, a few days after conception, is justified as the bunch of cells have no emotions, are not self-aware, and cannot think. I find this absolutely morally reprehensible, and I cannot find a single piece of material to rebut this. I would be much obliged if you could respond to this. Thanks in advance.
Well, it's wonderful to hear an atheist who is morally reflective upon this atrocity of abortion on demand, isn't it, Kevin? There's nothing about the abortion issue that is particularly religious. As I've said in my writings on this, it seems to me that there are two questions you need to answer about abortion to decide whether or not abortion on demand is ethical. The first one is, do human beings have intrinsic moral value? And I wouldn't say with him that all life is precious. I think he means probably by that all human life is precious. There's nothing the matter with eating eggs for breakfast. But human life, I think, is precious because human beings are endowed with intrinsic moral worth. So do you believe that human beings are intrinsically morally valuable? If you do, then the second question you need to ask is the developing fetus or embryo a human being? And that's not a religious question. That's a medical, biological question. It seems to me that the answer is yes. This is a human fetus or human embryo. It is not canine. It's not bovine. It's not feline. It's human. So because I think the answer to both of those questions is yes, that human beings are intrinsically valuable and that the developing fetus is a human being, I think it's therefore immoral to have abortion on demand, to take the life of this human being without moral justification for that action. Now, the objection that is raised here is that the developing fetus doesn't have emotions, self-awareness, and thought processes, assumes that those are essential to humanity. And if that's the case, Kevin, the problem is then little babies are not human because they don't have self-awareness and emotions and rational thought. So that this would justify infanticide, it has horrible moral implications. So I think that at most you could say that an organism which has the potentiality for self-awareness, rational thought, and emotions is valuable, but then the fetus certainly does have that. So the difficulty here for the abortionist is that if you defend abortion on these grounds, you're going to need to start defending infanticide too. And some of the more radical and consistent defenders of abortion do go that route and have said that you should be able to kill the newborns 30 days. I've even heard up to a year or so, yeah. 2 years after birth, because you don't really have self-awareness and self-consciousness until that stage, which I think most of us would say is morally reprehensible.
And they're just following the logic.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
That's right. So this is not a good criterion for being human or for having intrinsic moral worth. And if he wants to look at more literature on this, our friend Greg Kokel has a website called Stand to Reason, which has lots of material on it related to the ethics and legality of abortion.
Dr. Craig, a letter from Ryan here, and I want to go to the end because I want you to hear what he says. He really appreciates you and says, whenever you have a bad day, Dr. Craig, just remember there are thousands of people who you don't know and will never meet that think very highly of you. On top of that, the Lord of heaven and earth has used you to reach them and greatly enrich the quality of their experience with him. That should be a pretty awesome feeling. So, Bill, you hadn't had a bad day lately, have you?
No, I haven't, but that's very encouraging. Thank you, Ryan, very much.
This is a long, involved question from Ryan. So, Bill, we really only have an opportunity here to take a little of it, the first part of it, and quite good question. So keep looking at the resources on this particular topic at reasonablefaith.org. He says, I'm certainly not a Calvinist, but I've had a hard time settling on what I actually believe as opposed to defining my belief in terms of who I disagree with. This has led me to Molinism, a position that I find to be quite satisfying in many regards, and would have to say it is where I currently reside, although somewhat tentatively. However, that decision is not without difficulty. To that end, I have two questions for you. Number one, whenever the topic comes up among Christians, and this is the one we're going to take, Bill, whenever the topic comes up among Christians, other believers, at least those who have heard of Molinism, which I regard as theology's best kept secret, tend to respond with, well, where is that in the Bible? Or something along those lines. So maybe some biblical support for your view of Molinism. And what do you think about it when he says theology's best kept secret?
That's pretty funny, cool. Isn't it? I think it's getting to be more and more an open secret. The very fact that he's asking about it is significant. I want to make a couple of comments. First, he seems to be backing into Molinism based upon what he's opposed to. He disagrees with these other views and sort of finds his way into Molinism. I would encourage Ryan to look at the positive arguments on behalf of Molinism that I offer. For example, in my little book called What Does God Know?, which is published by RZIM, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, I lay out some arguments for Molinism that I think are very convincing as to why we ought to think that God does have middle knowledge, and given that, it will then provide the means by which he can providentially order the world. Now, as for this question about where is it found in the Bible, perhaps the best retort would be to say to the other person, well, where is the doctrine of the Trinity found in the Bible? Or where is the doctrine of the two natures of Christ found in the Bible? And what the other person will have to say is, well, that doctrine isn't found in the Bible in terms of a proof text. Rather, that is a theological construct based upon the materials in the Bible that makes sense of these biblical materials.
Boy, that is so important. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I had an encounter with a Jehovah's Witness over weeks of time, and he said, show me that verse, that one proof text that says that there are three persons in the one God. I want to see the verse. And I just had to explain, look, it is a case of looking at the full data of Scripture and how you handle the data, the doctrine founded upon this, the full data of Scripture.
Right. And in the case of Molinism, what you would do is look at all of the passages in Scripture that talk about God's sovereignty over the world, the way in which God controls the world and directs it toward his ends. And then you would also look at all the passages in the Scripture that affirm human freedom and contingency, and you ask, what's the best model for putting this data together? And then you would compare various theories, like Calvinism, that God unilaterally, causally determines everything that happens. That explains divine sovereignty very well, but it runs roughshod over the data of Scripture that support contingency and human freedom. On the other hand, so-called open theism affirms the data concerning man's freedom and contingency, but it cannot do justice to the biblical data concerning God's sovereignty and providential control over the world. But Molinism beautifully explains both of these without bruising the data. It allows you to have divine sovereignty with a full affirmation of human freedom and contingency, and therefore this is the best model for making sense of that biblical material. Another thing that you can show is that God does indeed have scripturally, knowledge of counterfactuals, of freedom. That is to say, these statements in the subjunctive mood of the form, if X were the case, then Y would be the case. And you can show that God does know these, that there are statements in Scripture that we as Christians believe are true. One of my favorite is 2 Corinthians 2:8, where Paul says, with respect to the crucifixion of Jesus, none of the rulers of this age understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Now, that is a counterfactual statement about how free creatures would behave in different circumstances. If they had understood this, which they didn't, they would not have crucified Jesus. So, if you believe that statement is true, if you don't think that's a truth value gap in the book of 2 Corinthians, then you have to say that God knows this truth. He knows this counterfactual truth. So, when does he know it? Does he know it logically prior to his decree to create the world? Or does he only know it logically posterior to his decree to create the world? Well, if it's only subsequent to his decree to create the world, then I think that annihilates human freedom, because now it's God who determines the truth value of that counterfactual. He brings that about, and that eliminates the freedom of, in this case, the rulers of this age. So it's plausible, if not required, that this truth be known by God logically prior to his decree to create a world and his selection of which world will be actual, and that just is Molinism. That just is middle knowledge. So I think that the doctrine of middle knowledge and the Molinist view of providence based on it is the best systematic explanation of the biblical data concerning divine sovereignty and human freedom.
Breaking news. Dr. Craig appears on Fox News. This media appearance was just one of many as Dr. Craig blitzed New York City talking about the work of reasonable faith and his new book, A Reasonable Response, Answers to Tough Questions on God, Christianity, and the Bible. Multitudes of people will realize after seeing this interview that they had misconceptions about God. Think about it. Christians and people of faith will be revolutionized in their thinking about how faith and reason work together, and they will no longer fear doubts and hard questions. Atheists, agnostics, and various unbelievers will perhaps take a second look, thinking that they had the corner on the market on reason and that Christianity was just blind faith. They'll have some real thinking to do. So we hope you realize how important the work of reasonable faith is, and that nationwide spiritual revival could break out when followers of Christ engage their minds and allow God to use them in deeper ways, ways very relevant to where we are in societies all over the world. And if you're not a Christian or you're an unbeliever and you put emphasis on the intellect and reason, you should commend Dr. Craig for his emphasis on the same thing, even if you disagree with it. If you're a follower of Christ, you should celebrate that we have an articulate spokesperson like William Lane Craig, whom God is giving more and more opportunities to speak in the big platforms of public discourse. Please support Reasonable Faith. You can do so by purchasing Dr. Craig's new book, A Reasonable Response, Answers to Tough Questions on God, Christianity, and the Bible. It's available at reasonablefaith.org. And you can click on Support Reasonable Faith there on the front page of reasonablefaith.org. We would be truly blessed by any gift, which would enable us to continue production of these podcasts and provide other resources for people all over the world. Go right now to reasonablefaith.org. Let us hear from you. I'm Kevin Harris. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.